Guardian Unlimited.
Welcome to the Guardian Science Podcast. My name's Alok Jha. I'm here in the pod with Bobby Johnson, who's jet lagged but looking fine for it. Ian Sample, the Guardian Science correspondent. Ian, no? Okay. this week's podcast involves stories. Doctors calling for us to draw a line under the MMR panic. What the next space shuttle launch means for NASA. And finally, an analysis from physicist Ken Bray of the England football team's tactics in the World Cup. So look forward to that. You can email us at science@guardian.co.uk. Or send us a blog, blogs.guardian.co.uk/podcast, or Skype, that's GU_studio.
The Guardian Science Podcast, sponsored by Volvo. The all-new Volvo C70 invites you to feel, open up, and see who's driving scientific advancement.
MMR, three letters that sum up one of the most hotly debated public health scares in recent years. The story begins in 1998 with a paper in the respected medical journal The Lancet. Andrew Wakefield, a scientist at the Royal Free Hospital in London, had found that traces of the measles virus in the guts of 12 children with autism. At a subsequent press conference, Wakefield suggested that the MMR vaccine could be to blame. A panic ensued, and the number of children given the MMR vaccine dropped as parents began to worry. The result is that now we're experiencing the largest outbreak of measles for 20 years in Britain. Last week, though, a group of doctors felt as though enough was enough. In an open letter, they demanded that doctors and the media draw a line under the controversy. Ian, you've read this letter. What are they saying?
Well, what they're saying essentially is that unless a lot of these children who weren't immunised, unless a lot of those get the vaccine, there are going to be further outbreaks and, frankly, a lot more deaths.
You spoke to one of the signatories of the letter.
Yeah, I talked to Dr. Helen Bedford. She's a senior lecturer in children's health at the Institute of Child Health in London. She's also one of the signatories of the letter. And I started by asking her if it was really these children who haven't been immunised, who are coming up to school age, that are really the major concern here.
We've now accumulated a lot of children who are unprotected. When you have very high levels of immunisation in the community, as we did prior to all the beginning of the concerns, there were very, very little measles around, but gradually we've accumulated each year another cohort of children, a lot of whom are unimmunised, and this offers a potential for spread.
And so who are the parents who are turning their backs on the MMR jab?
Well, it's very difficult to characterise them in any particular way, but there's two pieces of work that are very interesting. One was done in Scotland, and it showed that MMR uptake was lower in more affluent areas. And another study looked at the outbreaks that we had in London a few years ago, and they too seem to mainly affect the more affluent areas. So this would seem to suggest that it is the more affluent parents that are rejecting MMR vaccine.
So how do you explain that?
Well, it's very interesting, isn't it? I mean, it always used to be that it was the more disadvantaged groups that didn't get their children immunised. Mm. But we recently published some work which was looking at the primary immunisations. Those are the ones the children have in the first year. About 1% of parents overall, and this was in a lot of children, this was 18,000 children in the UK, about 1% were rejecting immunisation, and they tended to be older mothers who are more highly educated. And when we asked them, why are you rejecting it, it was about, this is my personal choice, I don't believe, you know, the vaccine, I believe the vaccine has risks attached to it, I would rather not take that risk.
But it seems as if these are people who are almost saying, after reading sensational media reports and probably being, by knowing that only one report was even alluding to there being any kind of link initially that kicked this all off, they're saying that they know better than the whole rest of the body of science who've come out against this. I mean, does it say something about confidence in government or science as a whole?
I think there's lots of reasons. I mean, the first is very obvious. Parents want to do their very best for their children. And because immunisations are a preventive action, you've got to be assured that they're absolutely safe, or as safe as possibly they can be. Now, of course, you know, we can't say that anything is 100% safe, but maybe vaccines need to have a higher level of safety than other things. But there are all sorts of other things going around, and I think you've highlighted the distrust in the government. You know, we had the BSE thing a few years ago, and I think that has altered perceptions about the government and the Department of Health. And although I hesitate to say it, I really think that the failure of the Prime Minister to say whether his child had been immunised with MMR has been a very important issue for lots of parents.
Just finally, is it too late to do anything about this?
No, it's not too late at all. It's never too late to get your child immunised. In fact, you know, you can get MMR vaccine as an adult. So it's certainly not too late to avert this possible epidemic. And I would urge parents who haven't had their children immunised with MMR to think again very seriously and to go and talk to their GP, health visitor, whatever.
Ian, what is the uptake of MMR in Britain now?
Well, the WHO says that if you're going to get this thing they called herd immunity, which is basically the amount of people you need immunised for it to actually have a really decent effect in stopping outbreaks, you need about 95% of people immunised. And at the moment, across the UK, we've got 83%. In London, it's even lower, 70.8%. So well below that sort of cut-off point that WHO would be looking for.
So worrying times for doctors. One of the things in one of the statements in the letter that was signed last week, it said that it's not too late to avert this predictable tragedy. It's time that due weight is given to the overwhelming body of scientific evidence in favour of the vaccine. And it says also, misguided concepts of balance have confused and dangerously misled parents. I think that the letter's talking about the media there. Do you think that's a fair comment?
Well, the question of balance, I think there's two points. I mean, there is balance in what journalists or what newspapers choose to follow and choose to write up, and obviously any scare story, any bit of research like this is going to get column inches. It's what they do. But the other issue of balance is whether you if the weight of scientists come out against something, you still have to have there's this misconstrued idea of balance is you have another voice, the dissenting voice on, and you can end up portraying it as an argument where people have split 50-50 on it.
Whereas
in this case, the overwhelming number of scientists were saying this is nonsense, there's no link between MMR and autism, whereas you had a very tiny number of people saying there was.
Well, the uptake's obviously dropped, but let's hope that this letter does draw a line under the situation as they're hoping. The space shuttle has become a byword for everything that's wrong with the ailing American space agency, NASA. Underfunded, falling apart, and perhaps on its last legs, the space program is a shadow of the glories of the Apollo days in the 1960s. The agency's latest mission, which will test whether the space shuttle Discovery can safely make it to space and back, is NASA's biggest test yet. At stake are the final few years of the shuttle's operations, the future of the half-built International Space Station, and NASA's ambitious plans to return to the moon by 2020. I asked Keith Cowing, a former NASA scientist and now editor of the NASA Watch website, what it would mean to NASA if the current shuttle mission somehow failed.
Well, it's very important because after the Columbia accident, there was a lot of doubt expressed whether the shuttle could or should fly again. It took NASA quite some time to get it to fly last year, and then problems still existed. And so this mission really amounts to a test as to whether you can actually fly the shuttle safely and within a reasonable period of time. If they can't, big decisions lie ahead for NASA.
You know, what does it mean for NASA? Does it mean that the space shuttle program and beyond is in doubt?
Well, I guess it depends on what you mean by fails. If, for example, foam comes off, everybody expects foam to come off. But if the vehicle is damaged in some way, or there isn't any damage, but material falls off in a way that could have been damaging in a slightly different situation. Dr. Griffin, the administrator of NASA, has said that if something serious happens with the shuttle, he might consider not flying it again. So, in essence, this mission is going to be kind of like dodging a bullet. And, of course, every shuttle mission is going to have the same risks that foam could come off or some other things could happen. So it's as long as the shuttle is flying, every time it flies, it's going to be a test flight. And every flight could be the last flight.
I mean, there's more than just the shuttle's future at stake here. I mean, if the shuttle is damaged in some way and there's more delays, then the half-built space station is not going to get finished.
Well, that's very important because we at the U.S., we started that. We invited international partners in almost 20 years ago. We have treaty-level commitments with Europe, Japan, Russia, China, and other countries. And for us to walk away from this is going to cause us, would certainly cause a serious row with with at least the European community and with Japan. Russia has its own capability to continue without the U.S., but it'll be a dicey situation.
I mean, just as a wild speculation, I mean, NASA's not going to just walk away from the space station, despite the fact that Dr. Griffin did say it was something that he wouldn't have built if he'd had hit the decision power at the time.
Well, I worked with Dr. Griffin at NASA at the time the space station was being built, and I believe what he's saying is at the time we were building it, it would have been in a different orbit, but the White House decided the Russians were going to be involved, and we had to shift the orbit much higher in order to accommodate the way that Russia launches things. And that, unfortunately, makes the space station less useful as a possible jumping-off point to go to the moon and to Mars. So Dr. Griffin also has really referred to it as an albatross in private meetings, so he doesn't want to push it any further than he has to, but he's bound to do it by policy from the White House and by treaty-level commitments that we have with other nations.
If the space shuttle, for example, doesn't fly very many more missions now, or if there are more problems, despite the fact that in itself it's a blow for NASA, I mean, would there be any problems for NASA's vision beyond sort of 2010, i.e. the stuff about getting back to the moon? I mean, would it lose credibility? And
well, yeah, there probably would be that. The issue with NASA right now, many people feel that after two decades of enticing people to support the space station, of getting our Congress to support it for a lofty list of reasons why, suddenly NASA's lost interest in this. If suddenly now the shuttle program can't fly and the station is sitting there half-finished at many tens of billions of dollars, a rational mind in Congress might look at NASA's next idea of where it wants to go and say, well, you know, you can't seem to finish the things that are on your plate. Why should we commit to something that's on the moon and on Mars? Shouldn't you be required to finish the things that you've told us you need to do? I mean, there would be a level of doubt that would be raised among the people who hold the purse strings for NASA.
And no doubt would shake NASA's own confidence. But can I ask you finally, all of this stuff we hear about NASA in the last few years, it's always been quite depressing. You know, the space shuttle's got problems, the ISS has got problems, it's underfunded. Is it all actually just a smokescreen? How excited are NASA scientists beyond the space station and space shuttle?
Well, NASA's, rather like any space agency, is a very large, diverse group of people with many projects. And if you talk to the people who are using the Mars rovers on Mars right now, these things have been going for several years, and they were only designed to work for 90 days, and they're having a grand old time just exploring this other world. So if you talk to them, everything's great. If you talk to the people running Hubble right now, they've had some problems with the camera that, on the telescope. Their future's uncertain, but they have a wealth of data they've yet to analyze. So it, as we say here, where you stand depends on where you sit. And there's some exciting things that are still going on a daily basis at NASA.
So these problems don't demoralize the large part of the staff?
Overall, it might, but again, like I said, when you've got the Cassini mission orbiting Saturn, and they're discovering new worlds, things that have never been seen before. So I guess as one part of the agency perhaps is getting a little depressed, that the other part cheers them up.
Great. Well, Keith, thank you very much for joining us. Good luck to the Discovery mission, I guess.
Thank you.
Now it's time for the news jam, where we're going to go through our favourite stories from the week just gone. I'm here with Ian and Bobby Johnson, who is looking very tired. As I said earlier, he's just been travelling around the globe. What have you been doing?
Is it secret? As usual, as little as possible. I've spent the last couple of weeks toing and froing to the US, and one of the things I saw when I was over there was MIT. I went over and hung around with some professors for a bit, and one of the things they told me about was this thing which may hopefully help people with epilepsy. Now, basically, there's a treatment at the moment called VNS, that's vagal nerve stimulation, which involves placing an implant pretty much like a pacemaker in your chest, but it connects straight to the vagal nerve, which goes into the brain. And when a seizure is happening, an epileptic seizure, a stimulation of an electrical pulse goes up into the brain.
Take your time.
And stops the seizure before it happens. Now, the problem with that treatment at the moment, which a fair amount of people around the world are using, is that it has to run like a pacemaker on a kind of clockwork scheme. Yeah. So it's just one pulse every 5 minutes, and hopefully it stops the seizure. Now, what I saw and what I was told about was a new way of analysing the brain's data and working out when a seizure was going to happen before it did. So kind of filtering out lots of noise from the brain and working out when the dangerous stuff was going to happen and then triggering the VNS.
So what does this new pacemaker look like?
I can't tell you because it's usually installed inside people's bodies. But it's a little disc. It's basically a battery.
Okay.
It goes under the skin, under the.
Did you say
by the clavicle?
They've actually tried this thing out, or is it still?
Yeah, the pacemaker, the VNS device, is in widespread circulation. Although because it's obviously an implant, it isn't used very widely like medication because people are a bit wary. But the different now they're able to monitor brain activity and trigger the pacemaker, then maybe a lot more of the world's millions of epileptics will go for the implant because it will be more effective.
What does the patient have to wear? Does it they have a hairnet of electrodes or something all the time? Or
the basic idea is they wear some kind of cap. The prototype is in basically a swimming cap, but they're hoping that they can put it into a headband or into the rim of a
hat. Sounds like Lobot from Empire Strikes Back, doesn't
it? Yeah, just imagine Bjorn Borg.
Would it work in a bowler hat?
I suppose so, yeah. Or a baseball cap, or maybe a Stetson.
Or a bishop's hat.
All right, enough of this.
A mitre, I believe.
Both of you, unless you've got something interesting to say, stop it. From one piece of medical equipment, which sounds promising, to one which perhaps might be scuppered by EU regulations, Ian.
This is
there's a phrase I never thought I'd say on a science podcast.
What did you say?
EU regulations. Go on.
These are proposed EU safety rules, which are designed to protect people who work in electricity generation and mobile phone industries. And the idea is that these people are only supposed to be allowed to be exposed to certain levels of electromagnetic radiation. The problem is that the rules also will infringe on MRI scanners, these magnetic resonance imaging scanners that are used widespread in hospitals now and have totally revolutionised a lot
of
medicine.
What kind of stuff is it, like brain scans?
Yeah.
Looking inside the body?
Yeah, absolutely. Brain scans, looking at organs. And you can do a lot of work with functional MRI now where you can get snapshots of activity changing in the brain, which is just really taking medicine forwards. But the fear is that this legislation will actually prevent people operating those machines because they potentially may be exposed to some of these levels of radiation. So basically a lot of scientists have come out and said that the EU has to very urgently review these measures, and they've only got 2 years to do it because that's when they're supposed to come into force.
Are these scientists asking the EU to say, look, can we have an exception for MRI MRI sort of operators? I mean, it doesn't matter that these people are going to have lots of radiation sort of fired at them.
Well, the argument is that the operators of this equipment won't actually get very high doses, but basically they are looking for either an exemption for medical staff because they shouldn't be exposed to these levels. But it may be something that they have to do in terms of how they operate the machines, which changes rather than actually cutting them out. And there are loads of these scanners around. You do about 100 a million scans in just Britain each year.
I was just wondering, can we have self-service MRI where you walk in, lay down and press a button and do it yourself? Wouldn't that work? Let's get round this straight banana issue.
You're tired.
I am, but I...
Sleep.
EU something or others.
EU
get away
regulations.
From hands off our MRI.
Hands off? All right, OK. Well, Bobby's going to start that campaign. We'll tell you all about it next week, I'm sure. The one thing I noticed, is anyone else bothered about the fact that the Hubble main camera isn't working anymore? Hubble Space Telescope, this is?
Deeply.
I can't say it's giving me nightmares.
Don't pretend. I know that while you're jet-lagged, you're not thinking straight, but this is the Hubble Space Telescope's main camera, which has given us so many of the most beautiful images from space over the last decade once it started working. And it's you've got the double Hubble deep field, all this stuff about where the galaxy came from, or the universe came from, rather, and just gorgeous pictures of stars and planets and all sorts. I mean, Anyone?
Well,
give me your laments.
When's Hubble being decommissioned anyway?
Well, it was planned to be decommissioned a little while ago, but it's carrying on, soldiering on, despite the fact that it's had no shuttle missions to refix it for several years.
So, you know, you can't complain too much that it's falling into disrepair if nobody's going to fix it. Maybe the whole NASA stuff we heard about earlier, you know, maybe they should get off their backsides.
Well, this is it. NASA are concerned mainly about the fact that they can't get the space shuttle up and down without problems, so they don't want to risk sort of sending a mission up to the space telescope because they don't feel it's justified.
What's your favourite Hubble picture?
My favourite Hubble picture? I've no idea. There's too many to count from. What are you trying to do? It's a picture of a lovely galaxy. I think it's a lovely sort of red colour.
Crab
probably.
Nebula.
Maybe one of those.
My personal favourite.
I can't actually name any stars myself or any of those sorts
it's
of things.
It's not a star.
Nebulae, whatever. Right, I'll stop that.
Busted.
Right now. I'm not going to say thanks to either of you, useless people. You're listening to the Guardian Science Podcast, and you're very welcome to get involved by email or blog, or you can send us a Skype message at GU_studio.
Further discovery can be found behind the wheel of the new Volvo C70. Visit www.volvocars.co.uk.
And now it's time for something a bit lighter, but to many of you out there, probably no less important than public health or space shuttles. Yes, I'm talking football. Regular listeners will remember that we had Ken Bray, a theoretical physicist at Bath University, on the show just before the World Cup started to give us his advice for the England squad. Everything from formations to tactics, all based on the finest science. Now, if any of you have been watching the football this weekend, you'll know that England, unfortunately, crashed out against Portugal, thanks to what was an appalling display in the penalty shootouts. I asked Ken, you know, why it is that we are so bad at this particular aspect of the game.
The kind of penalties we saw on Saturday simply aren't good enough. We've talked about this many times. Taking penalties where, A, you play the ball close to the goalkeeper, and B, where you hit it without particular conviction, will not get past today's top keepers. What they really should be doing is hitting the ball about the keeper's shoulder height to the right and left of his diving position.
Is this just a matter of practice, then?
I believe so, and I would criticise England on this occasion because it seems to me the penalties they took on Saturday were worse than the penalties they took in 2004. Infinitely worse. They still don't have the concept that there is a kind of penalty that you can take which maximises your chances of scoring. And to make the point again, there's a zone which the goalkeeper simply cannot reach, and it's not beyond the professional to play the ball consistently into that zone. And yet, all three penalties on Saturday were played close to the Portuguese keeper. They were hit tamely, and they were hit invariably along the ground. The initiative is moving to goalkeepers. They're tall, they're agile, they're going to get down to that kind of shot and gobble it up on every occasion. Ricardo significantly guessed correctly on every single one of the deliveries, not just one alloc. He even guessed the direction of Owen Hargreaves' penalty, absolutely spot on. And that shows how astute goalkeepers are at saving penalties these days.
Well, more than just practice, there's nothing else that England can do on that front, is there?
Well, I think there is. I mean, I was greatly concerned when I saw the shootout come about. The body language was wrong. They looked wrong in terms of their run-up. They looked wrong in terms of the confidence they should have been expressing. And since they'd won through to a shootout, it was down to the coach to motivate them and to lift them, you know, for the position they'd played for, frankly, for more than an hour. They'd got the chance to bring this game home, and unfortunately there didn't seem to be anybody on the England staff who could lift those penalty takers and make sure they produced a good shot.
Okay, well, let's talk about leave the penalties to one side. What about the formation that Sven had to play after Michael Owen got injured? He only really had one striker.
When you say had to play, I never thought when we spoke a couple of weeks ago that we'd be sitting here talking about England playing the most negative system that's conceivable, 4-5-1.
Can you explain that for me a little bit?
Well, yeah, what a loser's system. It's the kind of system you're playing where, as we said last time, there's very little delivery up to the lone striker. Now, A, we didn't have a striker in Wayne Rooney who was comfortable playing in that position, but it's the kind of formation that you play where you're trying to hold the game or at least avoid losing it. The idea that England would go out and play in a formation like that and attempt to win the World Cup almost defies, you know, belief.
Were there any positives in the way that England played?
I would take a great, in a sense, a great comfort in the fact that when they played with 10 men, they played with conviction and they started to show the kind of form we know that they've been capable of. And maybe that's a good signal for the future. But I think England need to sit down as a group, the team, the officials, and have effectively a drains up on exactly what went wrong. What are they going to do in the future to address this difficulty of five flops in the penalty shootout? What formation are they going to play? Are they going to pick a formation and select players who are comfortable with it? Are they going to get the best players and find a formation that suits them best of all? You know, and finally, I think that Steve McClaren should consciously and seriously think of getting an assistant coach who can coach the team exclusively in set pieces. And I'm not just thinking of penalties. I'm thinking of all the attacking plays in set pieces that England scarcely demonstrated. The free kicks, invariably, were disappointing. I didn't see many classic free kicks, David Beckham's apart. A large number of strikers seemed to play the ball into the wall. What was going on?
Well, that's pretty much it from all of us this week. We have had some wonderful letters. I think it'd just be too sort of craven of ourselves to read them out. But thanks to everyone who's written in, and also we've had a Skype message, but we're not sure what to do with it. So we'll let you know that
it's great, but we can't listen to it. That would be typical.
So, but keep sending them in. Please do keep sending in your blogs and your letters and your Skype. So they're very entertaining. Thanks, everyone. Bobby and Ian, thank you both, and we'll speak to you all next week.
Guardian Unlimited. What would Fonzie do?
I've got it. Hey.
What would Henry Winkler do?
I'm cool.